I'd like to talk to Tom Pritchard if you could get him out here.
Well, you want to talk to Tom? My good Lord, what happened to you?
White boy did this to me, and I'd like to talk to Tom.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Continental Championship Wrestling.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 88 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, for the very first time, I'll be taking a look at Continental Championship Wrestling, although that name would not last that much longer after this episode from April 23rd, 1988. And one thing I want to say about this particular show is I've complained a little bit in the past about the video quality of some older shows on YouTube or wherever I've been able to pull them from. And I probably shouldn't because they tend to be anywhere from 20 to 40 years old. But this one here, and I don't know what the uploader did to keep it in this kind of pristine quality, but it was pretty amazing to see in terms of just the video quality from start to finish. There's hardly any tracking issues whatsoever. But mainly, it's about time that I live up to my I'm going to do some non-WWE, non-WCW shows. Yes, I know I did ECW last week in a bit of a surprise when I said I was going to do the AWA. And then we had that purge off YouTube, which leads me into stuff like Continental Championship Wrestling, because a lot of the channels that I subscribed to in the past that would recommend videos to me that would be WWF or WCW, they're not there anymore. So now I'm getting recommendations for other stuff that I may not have seen in the past because the algorithm knows that I like longer wrestling videos, it seems. And also, for whatever reason, I like watching cat videos and old baseball highlights on YouTube. But I'm doing this even though at the same time, I am watching a lot of 1991 WWF, and I'm positively giddy when I am watching it, particularly some of the episodes in the fall that I've been taking a look at. But before I get into any more detail here, let me get in my plugs. You can email show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GFAllentownPod. And you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on all the goodies you can find at Pro Wrestling Only a little bit later on, such as fellow podcast on this feed, Lucha Afterground, where I will be appearing very soon to talk about an episode of Lucha Underground, which is nearing wrapping up its fourth season. And I will also be appearing on the Place to Be podcast, which is on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, covering the Saturday Night's Main Event for October of 1988, which features a Dino Bravo versus Ken Patera match, and I just can't wait to go back and watch that one all over again. Had a bit of a celebratory weekend. No, not because of the Red Sox, because I really don't care about that. Although I was glad to see Steve Pearce win the World Series MVP, considering that he had the highest WAR of anybody on the 2014 American League East champion Baltimore Orioles. And before you make fun of the Orioles, just keep in mind that they've won the American League East more recently than the New York Yankees. It's more because my wife will be starting a new job of her own So that seems to be somewhat contagious in this household of late. And that'll be starting up at the beginning of December, but she accepted the offer on Friday. So we celebrated the only way that a couple living in the greater Lowell area knew how, which was we took an Uber to the UMass Lowell versus Northeastern hockey game, which was the most nondescript sporting event I have ever attended in my life. Northeastern won 4-1. But I think I was much more concerned about drinking beer at that game because, number one, didn't have to drive home. And number two, the Songus Arena in Lowell, for whatever reason, has Harpoon UFO Hefeweizen on tap at one of the beer stands. And it's very difficult to find that beer on draft anywhere in this area now. I mean, you can go to the Harpoon Brewery, but that's one of the first quote-unquote craft beers that I ever really liked, like dating to college, because they had it in the BU Pub, which is a bar on the Boston University campus. And funny thing about that, that bar is actually closed on Saturday and Sunday. Yes, the university operates its own pub, but it's closed on Saturday. So just some great business sense there. So I may have had a little too much to drink on Friday night, you know, celebrating in the fact that I didn't have to drive home so I could get a higher alcohol beer if I so desired. Did not stay up for the 18-inning baseball game. So 12-year-old Pete is appalled by this, that not only am I not cheering for the Red Sox as I did back then, but didn't even stay up past the 9th inning of a game that went to 18 innings. But I did end up waking up at 5 in the morning because I had to bring my car in for a 90,000 repair. And the only reason why I woke up at 5 a.m. was because my clock said 6:45 a.m. So I just woke up at that point figuring, well, I'll just get up and I'll go downstairs, have a coffee, whatever. I didn't have my phone with me. It was already downstairs, so I was already woken up. I go downstairs. I look at my phone. It says that it's 5:05, 5:10 in the morning. I'm like, what the hell? Well, it turns out there was a power outage in my area for a very brief period, and my clock never got reset, and I never even bothered to look because I went to bed, you know, fairly inebriated the night before to actually see if the time was correct. So I just kind of sat around half asleep for a while before bringing my car in, which even though I had to wait there for 2.5-3 hours, I don't mind doing it usually because I actually do get in some wrestling watching there on my phone because they have Wi-Fi. Unfortunately, their Wi-Fi was complete crap in this case because it wouldn't allow me to play any video at all. So I'm trying to watch this week's show that I'm covering, Continental Championship Wrestling, April 23rd, 1988, and I just can't get to it. So all I was resigned to was sitting there at one of the desks that they have for people who are brought their cars in, but they want to, you know, do like remote working or whatever. Here I am writing notes about Tom Pritchard and the Dirty White Boy. There's going to be a lot more on that later in this show because this is probably the biggest angle in Continental. I don't know if it's the biggest angle in Continental history, but it's certainly one of the more famous ones. I like to talk to Tom. Anytime I need to talk to a person named Tom from now on, I'm not going to say, hey, is Tom there? I'm always going to say, I'd like to talk to Tom in honor of all this. Now, I'll be honest. I have not watched a lot of Continental or Southeastern Championship Wrestling, which is what it was called before the mid-1980s, and the name was changed to Continental. But the names are kind of all familiar who are here. The Fullers, you know, Dr. Tom Pritchard, Dirty White Boy, I know from Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Pritchard also was in Smoky Mountain as well. I also know a lot of these names from reading the wrestling magazines in 1988, from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, Inside Wrestling, all that sort of stuff. And as a kid, I didn't know where this promotion was. I knew it was somewhere. It was wrestling that I couldn't see, but had to exclusively follow through these magazines. So I would know these names, but I would never actually see them down the road because it was so regional and I was so far away from it all. Some background on the territory that I sort of picked up for those of you who might not be familiar. It's a combination of Southeastern Championship Wrestling and Gulf Coast, which is the Ron Fuller promotion. They bought Knoxville and the Alabama-Florida territory and named it Continental in 1985. It is part of an effort to compete with the WWF. Obviously, that didn't really go too many places, but when you're changing your name from Southeastern, which limits you to a certain area, to something like Continental, which is a much larger landmass. Although, Continental, I don't know if that's the best large landmass name, because when you say Continental, I immediately think Continental Breakfast. And when you say that, I just think disappointment from start to finish, because you're just getting little blueberry muffins, which, by the way, that's what they had out at the car dealership. They had little tiny blueberry muffins, and I had one of those. Fuller sold the promotion in 1988, which had actually occurred before this show, because TV executive David Woods is in the closing credits of this program, and Eddie Gilbert comes in as the booker around this time, and we will see him on this show cutting a promo, not in an actual match. One of the interesting things about Continental that I found rather interesting was that they cut a TV deal with something called the Financial News Network, which you probably don't remember all that well because it was not a 24-hour channel, as I recall, and it was bought and merged into CNBC in 1991. So as you get into the more modern era, that disappears and CNBC becomes a lot bigger. But back to the actual promotion itself, it would change its name from Continental Championship Wrestling to the Continental Wrestling Federation as of the May 7th show, and they made a lot of changes the week after this, vacating all of the singles titles to create one major title for the promotion, and then they would recognize the AWA World Champion as their world champion rather than the NWA World Champion, in part because Ric Flair was not coming to the territory to defend his title as it was under the old NWA model. So they could get dates on the AWA champion, Curt Hennig, which was eventually going to change into Jerry Lawler. So it would make sense. Jerry Lawler is the world champion. He comes down there and defends that title because that's really kind of more of a Jerry Lawler area than a Curt Hennig area, because it's weird thinking the AWA from Minnesota coming down to the southeastern United States, considering there's not a whole lot in common. It was also a split around this time of this promotion, where some of the guys went off and formed USA Championship Wrestling, which did not last to the end of 1988, but did run in competition with Continental. And there is not a ton of footage from the old days of Southeastern Championship Wrestling. You don't really see a ton of it on YouTube prior to 1985 and 86, which is always a shame. I mean, I'm not saying that I would sit down and watch chapter and verse 1981 Southeastern Championship Wrestling, but it would be nice to have it there, because it makes me sad knowing, well, you're not going to see any of that stuff. I know the example that always makes me the saddest is how the 1970s from San Francisco, you never get to see any of the work of the tag team of Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson. You know, Stevens, a guy everybody swears by, and Pat Patterson, you saw how great he was in the WWF as a 39, 40-year-old in 80 and 81. You can't even imagine how good he was in that team with Ray Stevens back in the day. Same for the guys who worked in Continental in the 70s and early 80s. Now, what we do have on this show is Dutch Mantell. As I said, a lot of recognizable names, you know, and Of course, he'd go on, become Zeb Coulter in more modern WWE, but had a very storied and interesting career amongst various territories, including here, Puerto Rico, even as Kansas Jayhawks and Jim Crockett Promotions. See the Wild Eye Southern Boys, which are actually the Southern Boys, Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers. They are the tag team champions in Continental around this time. And when they actually vacated all of those titles on the following week's show, they did not do anything with the tag titles. Those would stay in effect, and they had scheduled a tournament to crown a singular champion, and that tournament did not take place, I believe, until October. So it took them a while to kind of sort things through. And also, we have a hell of a lot of promos. They certainly like their promos on the show. As I said, Eddie Gilbert and a whole host of other guys we will meet on this show. But really, I am here for one reason. And I'm here to talk to Tom. I'd like to talk to Tom. The famous angle with Tom Pritchard, Dr. Tom Pritchard, and the dirty white boy, Tony Anthony. And what I can tell you is this is one where you probably want to go watch the video after I'm done describing it, or in advance of when you listen to that part of the show, because there's only so much you can pick up on what's going on here from the audio. I mean, yes, I can describe it and all, but you really should see it for yourself. And I'll, of course, go into detail when we get to that point. So let's get into the show with sports moment number one from the year 1988.
And look who's coming up. And with two out, you talk about a roll of the dice. This is it. High fly ball into right field. She is gone! In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
Better days for the Dodgers back in 1988 with Kirk Gibson hitting the home run off Dennis Eckersley, which was game one of that series, by the way. But they did manage to wrap that one up in five and have not won the World Series since. And I think they either set the record or they're getting close to it for most consecutive playoff appearances without winning the World Series. I'd say that the Dodgers' current futility is even worse than the Braves in the 90s and 2000s, because the Dodgers have every single institutional advantage you could possibly want. There's basically four teams that have that: the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Cubs. So really, it shouldn't be any surprise when one of those teams managed to win. But hey, Dodgers made their freaking bed with their bullpen, deciding not to address it. I mean, sure, you trade for Manny Machado from the Orioles, but instead of trading for, say, Zach Britton, who, by the way, gave up as many home runs from 2000... this stat just blew me away. Kenley Jansen, their closer, gave up 13 home runs this season, and then he gave up a couple big ones in the World Series. 13 home runs this season. Zach Britton from 2014 to 2018 gave up 12 total in those 5 years. Just blows my mind the way it went down. So the intro to Continental is shades of the movie Tron. I was kind of not expecting that with like the grid and all that sort of stuff. But our hosts are Gordon Solie, who's only got a couple weeks left. Next week will be his last week on Continental Wrestling. And Charlie Platt, which kind of sounds like the name of a crappy middle relief guy for the Cleveland Indians in the 80s. He also kind of looks like Skippy from Family Ties, but that might just be me. I always look at a lot of nerdy dudes from that era and just call them Skippy. Platt was an announcer earlier in the 1980s, and now he's back, coincidentally, with Gordon Solie on his way out. And for over two decades down in Alabama, he hosted a local morning show called Top of the Morning to You.
Top of the morning to ye on this gray, drizzly afternoon. Kent O. Brockman, live on Main Street, where today everyone is a little bit Irish, except, of course, for the gays and the Italians.
Platt lets us know that there are some changes coming very, very soon. They're going to kill off the Gordon Solie character. Now, actually, it's the name change, the singles titles being vacated, recognition of the AWA champion, because they're not getting any more dates on Ric Flair. So they go to last week's program, where Tom Pritchard has knocked out the Dirty White Boy in the center of the ring. We don't see how that ends up happening, but Dirty White Boy is laid out on his stomach. So Dr. Tom has his scissors in a boot so that he can cut a bunch of hair off the Dirty White Boy, which, good idea by him. Now, I had praised Pez Whatley many episodes ago when he cut the ponytail of Jimmy Valiant because he didn't run away with the scissors. With here, I'm going to praise Pritchard for keeping the scissors in his boot. Whatley kept it in the back pocket of his pants, which probably would make it really awkward to sit down. I mean, you could possibly impale yourself if things kind of go... It makes it hard to sit down. But if it's in your shoe, you know, you can just sort of walk around with it and no one's the wiser.
Dr. Tom Pritchard, now what's he doing? He just knocked him out with a 2x4. Hold on, he's got a pair of scissors in his hand. He's got a pair of scissors in his hand, and he's beginning to cut the hair from the Dirty White Boy. He is cutting the hair of the Dirty White Boy. He is out cold.
That makes it clear to any new viewer to Continental Wrestling that this feud is well underway. It's not like it started with Pritchard cutting his hair. It had been going on well before that. And when it comes to cutting hair, if you know anything about me after 88 episodes, I love haircut angles. And this is just another great example of it. And I'll be covering another one very, very soon, I can assure you, a rather famous one. And here's my commitment to the haircut angle. I actually took one of my sister's Barbie dolls around this era, probably 88, and actually cut almost all the blonde hair off it. I basically styled it into the Bridget Nielsen from Rocky IV as Drago's wife from that movie. Kind of the same hairstyle. My sister was less than pleased about that. I remember she was particularly pissed off about that whole thing. But it's kind of a large step to take to cut somebody's hair without their permission. I mean, this is why I love wrestling so much, because this is the only place where that is a thing. You never hear about, like, two dudes getting in a street fight and one of them gets knocked out and then he gets his head shaved. It is only in the world of pro wrestling. And perhaps I need to research this further, because I'd love to know, and I should just look this up, what the first hair and haircut angle was. I believe it was Gorgeous George, just off the top of my head, dating way back. But I'm wondering when it became like a much bigger thing, particularly in Southern wrestling, because Vince McMahon famously didn't understand what the deal was with hair angles. Of course, 84, Andre the Giant, and then Brutus Beefcake comes along in 87 and kills haircut matches for all of time, because every single one he was in was a de facto haircut match. Gordon is on the set trying to carry on with the program when Mystic, who you heard in the clip, was about to get into the ring, but then thought better of it because she had a lot more hair to lose. I mean, it probably would have been very difficult and painful to cut. There's probably a lot of product in it as well. She's also known later as the Dirty White Girl. And she saunters out onto the set wearing a pair of sunglasses that don't quite cover up what appears to be a shiner on her left eye. And this is where you hear the clip that I played at the opening of the show. I'd like to talk to Tom And that is like the name of this angle. I mean, you just do a Google search for I'd like to talk to Tom and you can find a lot about this. And she takes off the sunglasses and you heard Gordon say, oh my God, what happened to you? So Gordon dispatches Charlie Platt to go find Tom. And he kind of wants more of an explanation for what's going on here.
Well, are you telling me that the dirty white boy did this to you?
Yes, he did it because I didn't help him when Pritchard cut his hair.
Because Tom Pritchard cut his hair, you paid this kind of a price?
Yes, I did. And I just want to talk to Tom, please.
Well, all right. Good Lord. I'll see if we can't get Tom Pritchard out here.
Gordon's trying to be sympathetic, but he's a little bit flustered, as I think anyone would be if they just walked out and claimed a domestic violence incident and had a huge shiner to go along with it. But what Gordon should have kept his composure as a true professional, he should have looked for maybe swelling, because that's how you could tell the difference between whether this was makeup or a true shiner. The side of her face isn't exactly swelled up the way it would be if it was a true black eye. Also, there's no scratches or anything like that. Kind of just signs of resistance. Maybe I'm asking for too much here. I mean, you know, who knows what Gordon's condition was at the time. But he's a pro. I mean, he did maintain his composure for pretty much most of this. So then they run down some dates for Continental going all over Alabama and Mississippi over the next 4 weeks. This was like the longest ever segment. You might remember the World Wrestling Federation on tour, and then they would do like the next 10 days of dates. This one, they did 4 weeks. They went all the way up to like May 18th, I think it was. But they come back from that, and Gordon, I don't know, maybe he just had some time to get his act together or whatever, but he comes off as a little bit callous, I think.
I say that I'm very distressed as to what happened to that little girl, but I don't know, sometimes the company you keep can get you in trouble. But
I think the phrase that Gordon Solie was actually looking for there is from the Bible, and it's, you reap what you sow. And now that I think about it, that is way more callous than what Gordon Solie said. So I was absolutely wrong to question him. So Robert Fuller has to pay for time to get on this program. And I was a little curious as to why, but they do explain it.
He's suspended.
Robert Fuller is known for two things. Number one, the size of his genitalia. Number two, for being in the stud stable and for being basically the front man for that group across various promotions. And he had issues with Dirty Dutch Mantell at this time. And alas, because he is suspended, he has to buy his way onto the show to say his piece.
All right, Mantell, I'm going to talk straight to you, son. Another paid public announcement, not by the stable, because the part of the stable that really counted. I'm talking about myself and Golan has been busted all to pieces. And it's because of you, Buster Brown, you ugly-looking piece of horse meat. And I'm going to promise you one thing, Mantell. I want you to listen very clearly to me. Just as sure as you double-cross my beloved cousin, I'm talking about Jimmy Golan, one of the finest men on earth. I think my brother is garbage when it comes to what I think of my cousin, Jimmy Golan, one half of the greatest tag team of all time. Not the Southern Boys could split us, not in the Nightmares, not in the RPMs. It took nobody to split us but one dirty, stinking, low-down dog like you, man. Just as sure as whiskers grow on your body, and as sure as I took the dollars out of my pocket and laid them down, baby, to be standing here talking, I'm going to take care of your career high style, son. I'm talking about finishing it and for good. Get me off here, boys.
I wasn't even paying attention to what he was saying because all I could think about was he spoke for 68 seconds, and I wonder how much that would cost him in kayfabe universe to actually buy that time. And I came up with a figure in my head somewhere between $200 and $300. So I'm going to say it cost him $250 to cut that promo in kayfabe. I don't know. I kind of wish sometimes that his WWF and WCW stuff was a lot less cartoony, especially the Tennessee Lee business in the WWF, because think about when he's there in 1998 in that character, in that promotion at that time. Didn't really make a whole lot of sense in the context of everything that was going on. But Colonel Robert Parker in WCW certainly had his fun moments.
Boston 4, two goals by Casper, who's out there, two by Neely.
I never got to see it as a player, but boy, it's sweet as a broadcaster.
6 seconds left. Carbono just holds it. He says, I concede. And Greg Johnston, up from the Maine Mariners, played a game, and the salute to Lemlin. You never saw four better games than Reggie Lemlin turned in the nets for Boston. The Bruins wrap it up with four straight after losing the first one. More importantly, they'll get the break and the gap that they need.
Are they happy?
I haven't played any Boston Bruins moments during this sports moments series that I've been doing, probably because there weren't too many earlier in the 80s, but in 88, they beat the Canadiens for the first time in the playoffs in 45 years, which included 18 straight series losses. So that was kind of a big deal. He mentions how they lost the first game. I happened to be in Quebec City during that, when that game was being played, and there was a power failure in pretty much the entire province of Quebec that night, and I'm stuck in the Chateau Frontenac with my family. There's people who got stuck in the elevator. Luckily, my mother and sister got out in time, and I wondered, did the game actually get played, because, you know, there was no power anywhere from what we were told. And the waiter at the breakfast the next morning said, oh yeah, in Quebec, we have generators at two places, the hospitals and at the Montreal Forum. Bruins would go on and play the New Jersey Devils in the next round, which provides a nice segue to our next bout, the Red Devil taking on Dirty Dutch Mantel. I have no idea who the Red Devil is. You can't even find results, really, for the TV shows the way you can for WWF and WCW. But the 88 Devils were on a roll, so I guess this Red Devil in Continental is hoping to maybe capture some of the magic. I can't even hearken a guess as to who it might be. So if you know, please let me know. As for Dutch Mantel, who, as I said, was a staple in various promotions, he was huge in Puerto Rico back in the day, dating all the way to the late 70s. But when you say Dutch Mantel, I don't even think of Zeb Coulter, which, by the way, thank God that the Zeb Coulter character is not around today, given how different the political climate is in 2018 than it was even in 2013. When he was first doing the whole spiel with immigrants and all that. I mean, God knows if you had him out there talking about caravans and stuff, I think that, well, quite frankly, WWE wouldn't allow it. But every time I see Dutch Mantel, all I can think of is the time he was on Family Feud when the WCW guys were on there. And Ray Combs, who I personally enjoy, and I like him the best as the host of Family Feud, even more than Dick Dawson, how he kept calling Dutch Mantel Dirty, like it was his first name, the entire show. It's so magnificent. And I should just do, God, I really need to just carve out time to do a show just devoted to wrestlers on Family Feud, because it was just so great. Dutch, at this time, is the NWA Continental Heavyweight Champion, but he would be the last one. As I said, the singles titles would all be vacated the following week. He attacks right away, and the first thing I notice with him is not that he didn't take his shirt off, but that his boots are very berserker-y, for lack of a better word. They kind of have that berserker like fluff on them, whatever. Gordon Solie says he didn't take off his sweater or jersey. I couldn't quite make out what it said, but given how hairy Dutch Mantel is, how would you really know if he had taken off a sweater or not? I mean, it's not like he's like George Steele's like number one rival. Now that's a hair match that somebody should have booked. Dutch Mantel versus George the Animal Steele in a body hair versus body hair match. something like that. I would pay money to see that, actually, even though it would be totally gross, and it would take about an hour and 45 minutes after the match to actually shave the guy down. He chucks the devil to the outside, does his damage out there, and then tosses him back in. Very tight quarters on the outside. I want to say that there's probably only a couple of feet between the ring apron and the guardrail, and then there's a bunch of space back to where the front row is. Short clothesline, a power slam off an Irish whip, which didn't look all that great. I'm going to blame the Red Devil a little bit for it, but only 3 DiBiases out of 10 on my rating scale. And an elbow drop finishes for the victory for Dirty Dutch Mantel. He helpfully rolls the Red Devil out of the ring, which I like because you're really trying to stay on time here, and he's got an interview to do. You know what it is? He's rolling the devil out of the ring. It's kind of like a jobber exorcism that he's performing here. So Charlie Platt gets in the ring with Dirty, and they're focused very much on the split, the stud stable, and Dutch Mantel's involvement and all of that. And in talking about it, he invokes another man who also did a lot of big things in the state of Alabama.
You know, a famous American once said, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. And Robert Fuller's been running around. There's two sides to every story. And he says nobody could split him and his beloved cousin. The Nightmares couldn't do it. The RPMs couldn't split him up. Not even his own brother, Ron, couldn't split him and Jimmy up. But I'm proud to say today that it wasn't Wendell Cooley, it wasn't Danny Davis, and it wasn't the Southern Boys that messed him up. It was me, and I'm proud to say it. They didn't do it. I did it.
Nicely done, Dirty.
So while Dutch is channeling Martin Luther King, which is appropriate given that this show is taped in Montgomery, Alabama at the Civic Center, he kind of reminds me a little bit more of Teddy Roosevelt because he's something of a trust buster with breaking up the stud stable as he did, and also he has the required giant mustache. But he still wants a piece of Robert Fuller, who's on suspension as we've established, but instead he gets the fake Demolition who comes sauntering out. Oh, excuse me, I mean Detroit Demolition. Always kind of a interesting name because it looks like a complete ripoff of the Demolition gimmick in the WWF, except for the fact that the man in the gimmick, in the costume, and honestly, not pulling it off all that well. The outfit is not particularly flattering on Moondog Rex, but he is the one who did create this in the WWF. Randy Colley was famous for being the original Smash in only one or two matches on WWF television, and people saw him as a Moondog and chanted it at him. Just kind of a shame for the guy who actually kind of came up with the entire thing. So Dutch has declared the stud stable dead. Dirty goes ahead and asks Detroit Demolition if he's with Fuller. So Demolition just decks him, and they slug it out for a while, you know, just general, you know, exchange of punches. But now Lord Humongous hits the ring. Now, of course, that is from the movie Road Warrior from 1981. It's kind of directly lifted. And we actually met this character back in the Memphis episode that I did, episode 50 from April of 1989, character being portrayed by none other than Sid Udy, Sid Vicious. However, it does not really appear to be him here. While the hair in the back looks the same, you can kind of tell the difference between Sid Vicious and Robert Fuller. And you can immediately tell, that's not Sid. That looks a little bit more like Robert Fuller to me. So they tie Dirty up in the ropes, and with a few kicks, they just sort of leave him there, which is kind of funny, because they put him in a compromising position and then just kind of leave him tied up in the ropes.
I'll tell you what, Charlie. That isn't Lord Humongous, and I think I have an idea who it is.
I think it is the former head of the former state.
Yep, I think you're right. That sure appeared to be Robert Fuller, and that means he's in a lot of trouble with Continental Championship Wrestling. We'll be back.
It's not completely unfair for Robert Fuller to present himself as Lord Humongous, because I think he had been informally called that by some women down south back in the day. I mean, it wouldn't have been the most unfair nickname, based on things that we've come to know. So Fuller is suspended. Neat play for him to come back under a hockey mask. Kind of risky, though, because those masks where it's right up against your face, the Jason masks, if you will, do come off rather easily. I mean, and knowing from playing goalie in street hockey throughout my childhood, I was particularly glad to go to those masks that you see pretty much every hockey goalie in ice hockey wearing now. But it is fitting that he would dress up as Sid here, because those two would unite in the star-crossed 1993 WCW run for Sid, as Colonel Robert Parker would end up being his manager. They advertised some upcoming live shows, including some title matches that will be taking place, or not, because those titles will no longer exist by then, so a big oops. I encourage you to check out ProWrestlingOnly.com to explore other podcasts, such as the Military Industrial Suplex, which did an episode this past week, The Entumbra of Chattanooga. Always the best titles for that. Stacy and Steven did a episode on WWE Evolution this past Sunday, the all-women's pay-per-view. WorldCast is off this week and did not put together a best-of show. I had recommended one called How About That Cowboy? The Rise and Fall of Jay Saldy, chronicling the Dallas Cowboy on commentary through 1982, but it would be a little difficult to pull together. And, of course, there is much more at the website. Match reviews, features, retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, and matches. Playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows and movies, or even Family Feud. You can join the discussion by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums. It's been online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 4 million threads. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope forum, discuss more general topics from wrestling's history, like why did Ray Combs call him dirty? Dutch Mantel, just call him dirty. Check all of it out at ProWrestlingOnly.com. One of the things that I've learned about Southeastern / Continental is back in the day they developed a type of match that would later evolve into the King of the Mountain match, and the way they presented it was mostly similar to how the Royal Rumble would be, and coincidentally in 1988 when that started up. So right here, like a Royal Rumble intermission, let the promos commence for the upcoming Columbus, Mississippi show with Gordon. And first we have Nightmare Danny Davis, who many times tag team champion in Southeastern Continental, also in Deep South Wrestling as well, alongside Ken Wayne. He's involved in a little bit of a feud with the DI, which stands for Drill Instructor, which I'm ashamed to say I had to actually look up, even though I could have just looked at the guy and figured it out after a little while. I'm so used to like just seeing the name or hearing it and just looking it up. He's probably best known to modern fans as the founder of Ohio Valley Wrestling, OVW, which produced many of today's stars with John Cena, Brock Lesnar, in that 2000-2001 time frame.
That's exactly right. You know, plus he's also got those army fatigues, you know. He's the DI. He likes to tell people that he wants to run over Danny Davis. Let me tell you something. I've got a lot of support in Columbus, Mississippi, because I consider that Danny Davis's town, because the wrestling fans stand behind me every time I show my face there. They've never let me down. And do you know that this night in Columbus, Mississippi will be the same? The fans are going to be for Danny Davis, not you, D.I., so bring your bad self on down, and I'll show you something that they didn't teach you in boot camp, and that's what I'm going to do to you in that squared circle out there, because when it comes to that, that's my backyard, and you're playing in my backyard, and I'm going to come out on top with those good fans in Columbus, Mississippi.
Pretty sure that was generic Southern babyface promo number 7, something that you get out of a bottle. I don't have the result on what happened in that match, but as I've been doing this show, I actually found a website that at least gave the cards and some results for Continental shows from 1988. The venue there in Columbus is called the Lavender Coliseum, which I thought, is it because it's painted lavender? Is it on a lavender farm or something like, I don't know. But apparently it was named after some dude named David Lavender, and I couldn't find much more than that. I was kind of surprised. Usually arenas have a Wikipedia page or something that'll provide some sort of history, but not for that. So Charlie Platt is joined by the Wild-Eyed Southern Boys. This is well in advance of their move to Wyoming. And again, it just makes me think, would you rather live in Mississippi / Alabama or Wyoming? I think, for me, I have never actually been to Mississippi or Alabama, so I would be predisposed to move to Wyoming because I've actually been to not only Yellowstone National Park, but Laramie, Wyoming, and Cheyenne, Wyoming. I particularly like Laramie. It's a, you know, quiet college town, University of Wyoming. Fortunately, they have the specter of the whole Matthew Shepard thing from 20 years ago that, you know, they kind of have to shake, but I kind of like Wyoming. A little too much Eric Bischoff, I think, for my tastes, but it's something you just have to deal with. Steve Armstrong starts out, and perhaps he's been listening to too many interviews done by the guy who would become Eric Bischoff's best buddy years down the road.
That's right, Detroit Demolition, and what a big, mean man that he is, brother. He's an awesome individual, and he's already hooked up with the stud stable. Well, brother, you know Jimmy Golden is on a Greyhound bus out of town, brother. You may be next, and Robert Fuller after that. The whole stable is going to crumble, just like the Roman Empire did. It never stays around too long, you know, in history. It always repeats itself. The big established team always has to take a tumble. Well, brother, it's coming to you, Columbus, Mississippi.
It is a bit of a crutch to say brother in wrestling interviews, but I think Steve is actually being smart. It was something of a subliminal message, I think, because he said brother three times in that 30-second promo. It'd be once for Brad, once for Scott, and once for his younger brother, Brian. If you're wondering where Bullet Bob is, he's up in USA Championship Wrestling as part of that split that had happened. Tracy Smothers is going to face Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, the new booker in Columbus, Mississippi.
Right. You know, Eddie Gilbert, he's a big name star. He's been all over the country. He's no stranger to titles. The whole wrestling world knows what he did to the King, Jerry Lawler. He burned him right there in Memphis, Tennessee. You're coming to Continental, and you're coming to make a name for yourself. You're coming to Columbus, Mississippi. Let me tell you something, big guy. I will be there, Hot Stuff, and I'm coming. I'm going to be on fire.
I don't know why I'm watching these promos a little differently. It's probably, you know, where I come from as a wrestling fan, but when he's talking about being on fire, all I can think about is them converting Freddie Joe Floyd, the ridiculous thing that they had Tracy Smothers doing in 96 WWF, making him into Kane. And then I just started thinking of a world where Tracy Smothers does the Kane gimmick for 20 years and he's working in Saudi Arabia with The Undertaker in this cockamamie match coming up tomorrow. But I guess Glenn Jacobs did perfectly fine in the role, so who am I to second guess? And finally, we have Tom Owens alongside the ghost of WCW future, Mr. Bill Kazmaier. Seeing him outside of 1991 WCW is so bizarre. But Bill, for those of you who aren't familiar with his work, quote-unquote, he is kind of like a better groomed version of Braun Strowman, only just completely boring and unable to be an effective professional wrestler in any sort of way. And he's smarting from a recent injury that occurred.
Bill, as a report of that, take a look at this. The difference between these hands, if you will.
Well, I guess for proto Braun Strowman, nobody's going to get those hands.
And you're gonna need it.
But really, sometimes when I would watch Bill Kazmaier, I would wonder if he actually wanted to be a pro wrestler or if he just happened to fall into it because of his weightlifting career and, you know, having the body and the look for it. I mean, if he looks somewhat like Braun Strowman, that's a nice start. But when he speaks here, it almost comes off like a public service announcement against going into wrestling.
Well, I have to say it was quite a surprise. I've been in a number of wrestling matches, and I didn't expect anything like this. For the guy to treat me like that and go ahead and bust me up, you know, I can't invite any of the public to come in and try to wrestle or take these guys on, but I thought I could come in and hold my own. And if for anybody that thinks that they can come in off the street and jump on one of these guys and do well, they got another thing coming, because I got busted up and I tried it. It didn't work.
That really sounds like a man who's just ready to quit on everything in life, which pretty much describes the summer of 1991 in WCW, so I guess it is sort of fitting that he turns up again there.
Ma'am, lady.
Please, see if you can get him out here. I just want to talk to him.
Honey, come here a minute. Let me explain something to you. We have a television program we're running, and I'm terribly sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I just want to talk to Tom.
You, all right.
Please try. Just get him out here.
I'll tell you what, Charlie, you tried. I'll tell you what, hold on to that a second.
Mystic is back out looking for Tom. And at this point, Gordon Solie has had enough of his show being sidetracked by this woman making this request over and over again, that he's decided to unhook himself with all the equipment and go to the back, and Charlie will take over for a little bit, and Gordon will go fetch Dr. Tom Pritchard himself. And I put on my kayfabe hat for what went down backstage, and I got to figure that from Pritchard's perspective, you have the dean of wrestling broadcasters coming back there and asking you to come out onto the set because, you know, this woman is hijacking the show. So what I think happened is that Gordon, knowing that he's going to be leaving in 2 weeks anyway, probably at this point, says to Dr. Tom, look, this woman is hijacking the show. I would owe you a favor if you would come out and actually address this. And that's why Dr. Tom came out, is because Gordon Solie said he would owe him a favor. Now, I don't know what Gordon could possibly pay back Dr. Tom with, but hey, you know, I only get so far trying to imagine the kayfabe stuff. So Dr. Tom makes his way out. He's a little befuddled. And yes, he is confused enough to get caught in this web of deceit.
I don't understand what's going on here. First of all, you send Charlie Platt back to try and get me. Now you send Gordon Solie out of here, man. It looks to me like you and the white boy got some personal problems, lady.
I gotta stop it there for a second, because I'm not sure I endorse the crowd cheering that particular remark, because, you know, she is out there. We haven't established yet that she is faking it. She did explain and reiterate the story to Charlie, because he wasn't there earlier on when she was talking to Gordon. So I just want to get that out there. But I'm going to save my thoughts on this entire angle for the end, because I also have some background to go along with it.
Wait just a minute here. I told you a long time ago, you didn't need to be hanging around that guy, because he had a temper and he likes to blame other people on his mistakes. Now, I'm not condoning nothing. I mean, you look like you're in a little bad shape, and I would never hit a lady, and I don't think it's right to even put your hands on a lady. But to me, what happened?
Now, what they're doing to set this up is they come around the front of the desk that Gordon and Charlie are behind when they're doing all of their segments. And Mystic makes sure to kind of turn Dr. Tom around so that his back will be to the heel side, because he had come in from the left side of the screen as you're watching it on a television. So she's got to turn him around so that he doesn't see what's coming as part of this master plan.
You cut his hair and I wasn't there. I
know, but I didn't do nothing like that, because it's all up to you where you make your choice, Mystic. I told you that a long time ago. You make your bed, you got to lie in it, darling. You got to lie in this bed of life.
I'm sorry. Please, Tom, forgive me.
I tried to tell you a long time ago, but you don't have
is if you want to get your life straight, get your life straight. And don't
stop. Stop.
That's all right.
The reason why you can't hear them so well is the only mic picking it up is either Gordon or Charlie reaching across the desk. I think it's Charlie with the microphone. So when they're not really talking directly into the mic, it gets a little muffled. But you can figure out the back and forth that they're having. But that scream at the end with that studio audience really enhances this. Anytime you hear like the loud screaming like that with these great studio angles, it always adds a little element in my mind. I can't really put my finger on it. It's like the exact opposite of those Beatles shows from the 60s where it's all the girls screaming so you can't even hear them, and they couldn't even hear themselves play the instruments, so they were basically just like, screw it. This is the exact opposite of that because it's actually contributing and making it a little bit better. And the way that it's shot at various points, I'm kind of interested in the fact that usually on a wrestling show where you have a sneak attack like that, they will keep it on that hard camera that they had been shooting on. But instead, when the white boy comes out with the chair, it cuts to what I can only describe as like a sky cam, like almost like directly above, and kind of shows him running out like that. I kind of dug that from a director perspective. As I said, they made sure to get Dr. Tom with his back turned to it. And when he gets hit with the chair, Mystic starts clapping. And I've seen in some places she takes some heat for her acting in all of this. And yeah, it's not exactly great. We're talking Mexican soap opera levels here, but we're not asking for a whole lot to pull this whole thing off. She starts clapping like Vanna White during every spin of the wheel during Wheel of Fortune, you know, the little, yeah, like kind of like that, a little bit demure. And Dr. Tom, he gets tossed into the set, or depending on your perspective, Pritchard was being cowardly and trying to escape a la Marty Jannetty. Think, you know, something like Jimmy Snuka after being hit with the coconut and how he kind of pushed over the back set. He didn't get thrown into it. Dirty White Boy threw Pritchard into it. And he starts laying the boots, and Mystic lays in some of the softest kicks with high heel shoes that I've ever seen. In fact, they don't even show them, so another good move by the director to not show any of her exposing the business. A referee comes out, just unidentified guy, and he gets tossed by Dirty White Boy in pretty short order. And at this point now, shit's about to get real when Dirty White Boy pulls out a pair of handcuffs. So, no, he's not going to get kinky or anything like that. He's going to cuff Dr. Tom's hands behind his back so that there ain't nothing he can do about it. Now, if I'm watching this in 1988, and I like to put myself in the perspective of the fan watching it as it's happening at the time, I just figure a haircut is coming because an eye for an eye. But what had happened, and I saw this right before I recorded this segment because I decided to take another look to see if I could find the whole match where Dirty White Boy gets his hair cut. What had happened was Pritchard had come into the ring in disguise and hit the Dirty White Boy over the head with a 2x4, which made me laugh because this is in April of 1988, and that was a big thing then, because that is when the Hacksaw Jim Duggan hitting Andre the Giant over the head with a 2x4, that angle aired on the April 2nd, 1988 episode of Superstars, which, by the way, Greetings from Allentown, episode 8, way back in the archives. It's really a different show back then, 80 episodes ago. So then he, you know, cuts his hair. So I figure, eye for an eye, but no, because Dirty White Boy, he's got grander plans in mind. I'm going to beat him up a little bit more. And then, I'm not entirely sure where the noose came from. I don't know if that's something like, in Alabama, you have to have a noose on site, like a fire extinguisher or something like that. It would seem very, very dark to have that, but it's there. Dirty White Boy grabs it, puts it around Dr. Tom's neck, And he starts dragging him towards the ring. And you can see that, you know, to help this along, Pritchard is kind of crab walking so as to not die. Because if you put a noose around your neck, even if you're doing it for the purposes of a professional wrestling angle, there accidents will happen. And if you don't do this right, he could have, something really bad could have happened here. And again, this is so well shot because they go back to that sky cam and it looks so gritty from that high because it's very, very dark. It almost seems like it's happening in a dark alley even though it's in this arena. And it just makes it look a little bit more brutal as he's dragging him. But then, for all the great shots that they've gotten of this, and this is kind of the infamous problem with this angle, is when Dirty White Boy starts dragging him up the aisleway towards the ring. And what do you see but three police officers just kind of standing there. One of them just scratches his head, which is really just bizarre, to the point where I know on one of the old Exile on Bad Street that Chris Zellner did with Bo James on the history of Continental Wrestling, Bo had said something to the fact that they should have gotten the cops out of there, relocated them temporarily. But again, this was historically a promotion. It, granted, there's different people in charge now, I guess, that did not like to expose the business in that way. So perhaps that's why that they didn't position police officers in a different place for the purposes of having the angle come off just a little bit better on TV. And you're not getting really much play-by-play of what's going on because Gordon and Charlie are just kind of in shock. But as he's being dragged towards the ring, and the idea that the Dirty White Boy has is to hang him over the corner turnbuckle.
Can you see what?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, there it is on the monitor.
Oh,
Gordon. What?
Charlie, I'll tell you something. I've seen a lot of despicable things in my life.
What?
This is the worst thing I think I've ever seen.
That young, oh, man. That young, I don't know what to say.
What? Well, I think that I was taken in by...
That rotten, despicable, devious mind. Look at this. And she's party and parcel of this entire situation.
This is too
much. Oh, come on.
Now,
hey, we've got to get some help down here. We've got to get some help down here. We've got to get some help. Tom. He appears...
I don't know if all the commotion is killed the monitors in the back or not.
I don't know, Charlie, but I'll tell you something. Somebody's got to get some help down there. We've got to get some help down to Tom Pritchard. He may have ruptured something in his throat, but Pritchard is in a world of trouble here. And, thank goodness people are there. Thank goodness. Frankie the Thumper Lancaster, a host of others. Well,
you would think that the baby faces would come out and help him a little bit earlier, but I am glad that Charlie explained that delay by saying, well, maybe it knocked out the monitors in the back. The truly evil thing for the Dirty White Boy to do would be for him to knock out all of the monitors first so that he can go out, do his damage, and nobody will know about it. I think, in reality, with the kayfabe hat on, is the dudes are not sitting there just watching the monitors waiting to do run-ins. They're sitting around playing cards, taking crap. Like, they're not waiting for a guy to be dragged with a noose in Alabama and then hung from the corner turnbuckle. That's not entirely what they're expecting. Gordon had alluded to some sort of blood that you really couldn't see on the video, in part because it just didn't turn up there. I'll get into that in a second, because it's pretty gross how that all happened, because you can't really blade when you got both hands tied behind your back. This did have the effect of heating up the territory for a little while. And Eddie Gilbert gets credit for this because he happens to become the booker at around this time. But he did not book this. This was all put together by Tom Pritchard and Tony Anthony, the Dirty White Boy. They came up with the idea themselves, although it had been previously done in other places. Gilbert just green-lit it, whereas the previous bookers did not want to do this because it is on a line where I could see that maybe you think this is in bad taste. Tom Pritchard did a Reddit AMA, that's Ask Me Anything for you kids out there, where obviously the subject of this angle came up. And here is what he had to say. That was something I came up with when we needed to further our angle. I watched The Hangman in Texas when I was a kid, and he brought a noose to the ring. After a match, he hung Nick Bockwinkle and beeled him from corner to corner. We needed something vicious, so I suggested handcuffing my hands behind my back. This way, there would be no doubt that I was being hung, choked, and had no way out. Kind of crazy, but we were in Alabama, and we wanted to get people talking. I remember watching wrestlers do hard ways and crazy stiff shots for love of the business, and this was along those lines, in my opinion. Yeah, and I sort of agree with the way he's putting it. I mean, it is on a line, and I could see why some people would be offended by it. The only thing I'm really offended by is one detail of this that, as I mentioned, I did not need to know. And this is in a separate interview where Pritchard said, "We had taken some blood from my arm and injected it into a condom. We tied the condom off, and I had it in my mouth. Steve Armstrong had a blade, and he was supposed to cut the condom, and I'd bleed from my mouth. The blood was supposed to show up better against the yellow shirt. But the cameras missed the blood. The only people who saw that part were the fans in attendance at the TV taping." I wonder why he wore a yellow shirt instead of the traditional white shirt that you see when guys are going to bleed on television. I'm thinking Jimmy Cornette and 88. There's a whole host of others. You wear the white, you know how good the blood shows up. I don't know why he would have chosen the yellow. But a condom full of blood? Good God. That's like the grossest thing I've ever heard. And this is a business where dudes would keep blades in their mouth. Some guys would actually do that. I think Bret Hart used to do something along those lines. But God almighty. So how do I feel about this angle? Obviously, there's a reference to domestic violence, but it is not domestic violence because it is two heels getting together and using that notion to create even more heat. So you heat it up at first, and then you make it extra hot when you find out that they had been faking it and you had been playing on people's sympathies for Mystic, who had fallen for that. So you're healing out the same guy twice. I would not recommend doing this angle any more than, say, once every 10 to 15 or 20 years. You're certainly never going to see it in WWE because with the noose and everything, no way they're going to do it. And it's kind of hard, I think, in an independent promotion because I'm not sure that maybe the money wouldn't be there for a guy to take that kind of risk to do that. But it sure as hell stands out, and it stands the test of time 30 years later because people are still talking about it. And honestly, I love the fact most that Tony Anthony and Tom Pritchard came up with this on their own and pitched it. And I love that sort of freedom that the talent had. But there is a bit of an afterword, an appendix to all of this. On the following week's show, and I usually don't play clips from the next week. I know I did it with the Bruno Larry saga in order to, you know, fully introduce that. And Tom Pritchard comes back the next week. It happens to be Gordon Solie's last week as well, and he gets in a line as well. The fire from Tom Pritchard burns so hot through your television screen that you should just throw a bucket of water at it.
Gordon, A lot of things have happened to me in my professional wrestling career. I've had a lot of people jump me from behind. I've had 3 concussions. I've had broken bones. But never in my life have I had someone come up here and have a lady with a black eye ask for me, not once, but twice, to come out here and ask for my help. And when I came out to this set, I came out here to find out what the situation was. Not only did you come back and ask me, but Charlie Platt came back and asked me. She has said she's got a black eye. The dirty white boy beat her up. Well, I wanted to find out what the deal was. I came out and I asked her, what happened right here on this set? Right here on this set. And you know, I've been deceived before. I've been deceived one too many times this time, white boy. Because not only did you hang me from the turnbuckle out in that ring, and not only did you try and end my career, but you tried to end my life, pal. When I was sitting there choking and coming within an inch of my life, I kept thinking, and my life flashed before me. I said, what am I doing out here right now? Well, I'm going to tell you, when I see you, you're going to know that you're a man wanted dead or alive, because that is what I'm coming after. A piece of you, and if it takes a noose, if it takes a baseball bat, that's what I'm going to do. I don't care anymore. If you want to beat somebody up, pal, don't do it to a woman. Do it to me, to my face, because I'm going to do it to you, to your face, and there's not a thing you can do about it.
I wouldn't take $1 million right now to be the dirty white boy, I'll guarantee you that.
While I understand Gordon's sentiments there, it would be several years before the dirty white boy, Tony Anthony, would literally go in the toilet. And somebody has to actually follow that. And I don't know how it's shot in the arena. It may not be in sequential order, but we have a tag match between the grappler, Len Denton, teaming with Mark Young, taking on Nightmare Danny Davis and Wendell Cooley. And Mark Young is the one that I kind of want to focus on because he is the adopted son of Chief J. Strongbow. He passed away in 2016, fairly young, and he bounced around in various promotions, and Continental seems to be where he did the most stuff, where he was forced into the honor guard with the DI, the drill instructor, and ended up costing the Nightmares the tag team titles at one point. It's not a whole lot to say about the other guys. I mean, you're throwing them out there on TV after this, so what are you going to do but work an arm, as Davis does, of Mark Young? Again, I feel bad. Like, how do you follow that? I mean, like I said, maybe it wasn't taped immediately after, but to actually have to go out there afterwards. I mean, at least the Jake Roberts Cobra Bite of Randy Savage, which I think might be the last angle that I've covered on this show that is as shocking to the senses as this one, that closed that episode of Superstars. And on next week's show, I'm going to be doing another episode of Superstars that will also have a shocking angle that will close the show. Grappler is in. He's cross-bodied by Davis for only a 2 count. Then Cooley controls for a bit, and he and Davis cut off the ring. A gut-wrench pile driver is used by Davis as a transition move in 1988. I was very surprised to see that. When I saw that gut wrench pile driver, well, first of all, I think of the Steve Austin injury from SummerSlam. And secondly, I think this is 1988. That should put a guy away. But it is actually Wendell Cooley in with the bulldog on the grappler to pick up the 1-2-3. Bit of an easy win for those two guys. I don't know what it is. When I see the grappler, and just a masked guy who I know who he is, and he's not, he never strikes me as a guy on the enhancement level. When I see a masked guy like that, I immediately think Mr. Wrestling 2 or The Assassin, not somebody who's going to get beat in 2 minutes on TV right after a hot angle has aired. But hey, this is a Cooley Down match.
Gonna make a change. for once in my life. It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right.
Sure, Michael Jackson was making a change with Man in the Mirror off the Bad album, which had actually fallen to number 11 in that week in 1988. And so here is new booker Eddie Gilbert at a new desk that they had cobbled together from somewhere since the previous set had gotten destroyed, kicking off his memorable run in Continental in 1988. When I see Eddie Gilbert, knowing that he passed away in 1995, and you think of all the stuff he could have done into the 90s, I don't really see him as a fit in the WWF during the Attitude Era, although I think he would have been a creative force somewhere at some point. But imagine, even if he had stopped wrestling in 1995 and if he had lived on, imagine if he had a podcast in this day and age, in the era where every wrestler has a podcast, or every wrestling personality, from your Jerichos and your Austins to your Sean Mooneys and all that. Eddie Gilbert, given his penchant for really not giving a crap who he offends, it would be just truly amazing. Now, as his introduction to the Continental crowd, Eddie Gilbert just shows that he did not read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
You know, the thing that's really getting me, I've been here, I saw a lot of my friends back there. I saw Robert, Humongous, I saw him earlier, you know, and I saw what happened just there. This must be the place that everybody's been telling me about, the place that's really hot stuff. Everybody's been telling me Continental Championship Wrestling is the place where you come hot stuff to make the reputation for yourself. Well, see, my reputation precedes me, Gordon Sully. You know who I am. These rednecks out here in Alabama know who I am. Everybody knows who the legend, who the greatest looking, who the greatest wrestler in wrestling day is. It's me, Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. Right?
Missy Hyatt would soon follow Gilbert in from Memphis, and they would make a video promoting Missy Hyatt where she's walking around and hanging out by the pool. It was quite a bit of fun, I must say, to watch. And he had fireballed, Gilbert had fireballed Jerry Lawler in Memphis not long before this, which Gordon makes mention of, a bit of a famous thing. And Gordon wants to throw to the footage. However, there's a bit of a problem, and there's nothing he could do about it.
And do you remember what happened?
Yeah, he caught on fire during the match.
You threw fire at him.
No, I did not. I've never thrown fire in my life. Don't you start either.
I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll tell you what we're going to do. Let's just go ahead. Spruce, let me call on my director. Spruce, would you roll that video, please, of Eddie Gilbert, Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, against Jerry the King Lawler, please. Pardon me? What do you mean you can't do it?
Gordon, the tape has been taken. We had it on the shelf and somebody has taken the tape. We don't know where it is. It's just disappeared.
The tape was on the shelf and now it's gone?
Yeah, it's disappeared.
You don't have the tape?
No, we don't. We can't find it.
No, I'm sorry, Gordon. I just want to let everybody know that Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert's here for a reason. You know the reason. The general manager, Jack Curtis, knows the reason. And I also hear that next week, everybody is going to hear the reason. Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, I'm sorry you don't have the tape in that just tube. I'll see you next week, Gordon. Okay, bye-bye.
I think we can figure out who ended up taking the tape, but let's just say that it was Hornswoggle anyway and give him the credit for it. That's kind of some funny stuff, going the extra mile to keep them from airing footage of him at Memphis. You know, I don't know, throwing a fireball, you don't really see that these days, probably for good reason. Gordon tries to intro the tag team title match we have coming up with the Wild-Eyed Southern Boys, but once again, Mystic crashes onto the scene along with the Dirty White Boy. But Gordon, he doesn't really want to have any of it this time after what went on earlier.
The Continental Tag Team Championship upcoming momentarily, and as you can see, our situation... How dare you even bother to come...
you were.
That's all I...
That's it. You come here and talk to the Alabama champion. Tom Pritchard!
I don't want to talk to you.
He said you was wanted dead or alive.
I don't want to talk to you. Let's go to the ring, please. Go to the ring.
Yeah, Gordon's just had about enough. And I think he's about one scotch away and one interruption away from just channeling Samuel L. Jackson from that movie and just screaming at them and then capping it off with, "Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell." I don't think I would call Tunnel of Love, the album by Bruce Springsteen, his best work, or even the live shows on that tour, the best tour that he ever did. I tend to enjoy the River Tour from 1980 and 81 the most, but those shows from 88 are very unique in terms of, they're not like the Springsteen and the E Street Band shows from any other era, because you have like a whole horn section, maybe a little bit like the ones in the 2010s, but for the era in the 80s, 90s, and in the first decade of the 2000s, that tour kind of stands out to me. Plus, I like the Tunnel of Love album more as time goes along. So we have the tag team title match, as promised. The Wild-Eyed Southern Boys, Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong, are defending against the D.I., and Detroit Demolition. Now, I've been lobbying for a baseball trip to Detroit for a couple of years. I've gone with my friends to Minneapolis earlier this year from when I did one of the AWA shows. And then a year ago, we went to Milwaukee, flying into Chicago first and then driving up there. One of my friends, he's very anti-Detroit because he doesn't like Comerica Park because he went there like 11 years ago. Me, I just haven't been. And also, every time I've been to the Detroit airport, they're taking good care of me in terms of the beer, offering of side shots, because the one great thing about the Midwestern United States is it is side shot country, where in some places when you order a beer, you have to actually opt out of the side shot, like it's a privacy agreement or information sharing on a website or something like that. So anyway, the Detroit Demolition is actually the name of a women's football team in the National Women's Football Association. I don't know if that's still around, but I don't think it has anything to do with the Randy Cauley wrestling character. Confederate flag being waved by Tracy and Steve, which is perfectly fine in Alabama in 1988. As you get into the 90s and they work their way northward a little bit with Tracy Smothers, he wouldn't be able to wave that Confederate flag, which explains the switch to an Italian flag with Tommy Rich's picture on it. And why the hell is there not one single photo of that flag on the internet? I've brought this up now like 5 times in the history of this podcast. The Tommy Rich picture on the Italian flag is the greatest thing ever. As I said, I was embarrassed earlier in the show that I had to look up DI, standing for drill instructor, and he's kind of viewed in my research as a professional sort of heel. Yeah, he's not Sergeant Slaughter from 1980, 81 to 83 or anything like that, but he's perfectly good, a strong heel for the territory. This match is one fall and TV time remaining, and there's a good amount of time left on the video, at least certainly more than 10 minutes. And we get Monkey Flip by Armstrong on Detroit Demolition, and then he offers a test of strength, Detroit Demolition does, being the much bigger man. But Tracy Smothers, who's now in the ring, Tracy Smothers is a weird dude, and he does bizarre things, and this is no exception, where he crawls between Detroit Demolition's legs and drop kicks the DI off the apron. Meanwhile, on commentary, Gordon and Charlie can't stop talking about the whole dirty white boy situation with Tom Pritchard.
Missed it a few moments ago. I don't think I could have stood in the ring another second and listened to that.
Well, it was a disgusting situation, and I frankly
would even eliminate the Ms. or Miss in front of her name.
That is a disgusting act.
I guess the argument against closing the show with the hot angle is you can spend some time further putting over the angle by talking about it during another match. Tracy escapes from the clutches of the DI, who's holding him on the apron, miscommunication spot between the heels. DI actually ends up in the ring. At this point, I notice that there's a bunch of empty seats behind the front row. I can't really comment on how business was going in Continental, but from what I've read, it did pick up as a result of the angle with Pritchard and Dirty White Boy, which got people talking and got them watching again. Blind tag by the babyfaces dropped toehold into a leg drop by Steve Armstrong. And they actually go to commercial at this point. And I'm just glad that there wasn't a suicide dive to the floor to prompt the commercial break. I mean, I literally was watching Raw on Monday night. And Finn Balor does a dive to the floor and they go to commercial right afterwards. It's such a cliche at this point. I mean, all you have to do is see Finn Balor set up for it and you know you could, you know, you have an extra 15 or 20 seconds to take a whiz or whatever. Near fall on Detroit Demolition as they return from the commercial. It feels like they missed something, but the tape machines are rolling, as they do say. And Detroit Demolition kind of looks like crap here. He looks about as bad as Axe did at the 1990 Survivor Series, which I hold up as the gold standard for as bad as anybody has looked on a pay-per-view, at least from the perspective of somebody who was once really, really good. His Axe is huffing and puffing around the ring for the 2-3 minutes that he's there before he's eliminated. Tracy is in peril for a bit, but then he dodges a charge. Then they work the left arm. This match seems very oddly structured. For some reason, I was expecting traditional Southern tag, but it seems to be more back and forth. I was kind of expecting more of an extended heat segment where either Tracy or Steve is in peril for like 4 or 5 minutes, but like a classic Southern tag match, but it seems to be set up slightly differently here. Demolition, he grabs hair on the apron, the old Brett, his take on the Bret Hart transition spot where Brett would usually just sneak in a knee off the Irish whip. And then they get another ad during the match. So this is a 2-ad match for more shows coming up in Continental. And then they come back from it, but they don't go to the match. And I'm like, what the hell just happened here? Did they, because they show at the desk, the Southern boys are now at the desk and they're giving an interview about what took place earlier. This is very confusing that how they did it this way. In the middle of their match, all of a sudden you smash cut to them doing a promo about something else. And Nightmare Danny Davis is there as well.
Exactly right. I mean, he took and he handcuffed the man like he was just a piece of garbage.
Did Davis just say that he handcuffs pieces of garbage?
No.
Well, all right then. Steve Armstrong says that Pritchard is a black belt, so for whatever that's worth. Back to the match with the guys who were just talking at the desk, and all four are in the ring, and the two heels collide in the center. Pair of drop kicks, and then DI, somehow, he gets a full Nelson on, and Detroit Demolition comes off the top with what appears to be what is known as a swagger stick. Not a Jack Swagger stick, but like that thing that Sergeant Slaughter would often have with him back in the day. And you think, okay, well, this is a disqualification because the bell rings and Steve and Tracy retain their titles that way. Well, they retain the titles, except they say that it was a time limit draw, which I've never quite seen that finish for a time limit draw, but hey, that's one way of doing it. It didn't really seem to help the wild-eyed Southern boys at all, but again, when you have that angle earlier in the show, I guess you can kind of throw out the rules of, you know, how you would ordinarily do the rest of your show. But we have one final promo segment here, and it is a familiar face, Downtown Bruno, in Continental Wrestling, years before he would become Dr. Harvey Whippleman. But he has somebody very familiar standing behind him, Lord Humongous. However, Big Sid is not behind a hockey mask, but rather he has a hood on that makes it look like he was captured by Al-Qaeda or something. He's just kind of standing there with his arms crossed like that. It's very, very weird. Of course, his hockey mask, I think, you know, Fuller probably absconded with it and is out on the town or whatever. So now Sid has got to get a new one.
Gordon Sully, imagine if you can. People, imagine if you can. Detroit Demolition standing right beside Downtown Bruno and Lord Humongous. It blows my mind. And if that would have been Detroit Demolition and Lord Humongous with Downtown Bruno in that match, the Southern Boys would no longer be Continental Tag Team Champions because it would have been a title match and we would have won. Keep that in mind because we're going to be here for a long, long time. Southern Boys, we'll see you in Junction City, Kansas. Oh, yeah, baby.
I don't know what the hell he's talking about with Junction City, Kansas. Does he think that they're already moved to Wyoming? Can he, like, see into the future or something? I don't quite understand what he's saying because this promotion is Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. So I don't know where the Kansas reference. And they couldn't let Sid talk for even, like, 10 seconds, say something menacing. Really kind of disappointed with all that. And they wrap up the show with, and they had used this song for bumpers earlier on, the Robert Tepper No Easy Way Out that you recall from Rocky IV. Two Rocky IV references in the same show. From the scene where Stallone is all sad because he unwittingly killed Apollo Creed, which, by the way, involuntary manslaughter for not throwing in the towel. And he shifts in the car like 1,500 times for whatever reason. And as they play that, they have closing credits and they show a replay of the hanging, just in case you missed it earlier, which prompted me to tweet out because I saw one of the credits for production assistant Robert McFerrin. That made me laugh. Like Bobby McFerrin. And I said, well, Continental, always known as a happy-go-lucky territory in spite of the hangings. And that's a wrap for Continental Championship Wrestling in general, but also just for this show, April 23rd, 1988. My podcast plugs on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn. This week, they take a look at the first ever New Japan Pro Wrestling show from 1972. Very interesting thing to review that I never would have even thought of that at all because of the language barrier. So it's interesting how they sort of tackle that topic. And the wrestling podcast about nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis. I don't know what those OVP guys refer to him as, mean Mike Crockett. I've never found him to be particularly mean, unless they mean as in like average Mike Crockett. You know, kind of like that Sanders guy from WCW who was so bland. I don't even remember his first name. Anyway, on that podcast, you're talking about scary matches in the spirit of Halloween and all that. And on the Sportscasters with my occasional podcast partner, Steve Bennett, he has an interview with the preeminent sports author in the world right now, in my opinion, Mr. Jeff Perlman, who seems to have taken the mantle, I think, away that John Feinstein would have held in the previous generation, because Jeff Perlman has a very, very strong body of work, particularly if you're into baseball and football, with his latest on the history of the United States Football League from the mid-1980s. So do check all that out. But I still have one piece of business to attend to, and that is another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this one will be rather brief because there are only 5 comments on this video, which, as I mentioned, but it warrants mentioning once again, the pristine quality of this is really just amazing and sort of blew my mind. As always, this is an actual comments from actual, I presume, YouTube users. We'll start out with Booking the Territory, which is a podcast hosted by Mike Mills. He weighs in with the first comment here. The video quality here is tremendous. Good stuff. Thanks for uploading. So I'm glad we get the word out about all that. David Fulham says, Dirty White Boy beat Pritchard so bad he came back thinking he was Roddy Piper. And yeah, one of the criticisms of, you know, Tom Pritchard was sometimes he would, you know, go into that Roddy Piper voice and he would be kind of an imitation of the Hot Rod and all that. So I guess you can trace it back to this angle. He just got whooped so badly that he transformed into somebody else. Another 1980s sitcom-y kind of trope. Mufo Zombie says, wow, this is better than Christmas. Thanks. See, people love stuff like this on YouTube. Wrestling on YouTube is so great. And the award-winning WWE Network. Let us not forget that as well. Euler Diehard says, agreed, this is fantastic quality. Better quality than the episode copies of these episodes I had. Thanks so much for these, Bullet. I think that might be a colloquial name for the uploader. Perhaps they know who this person is. And finally, Def Leppard Van Halen says, Saturday, April 23rd, 1988 was a great day for viewing pro wrestling for many reasons. Number one, the beginning of the Jake Roberts-Rick Rude feud involving Jake's wife Cheryl. Number two, Barry Windham joining the Four Horsemen. Number three, Lex Luger and Sting winning the Crockett Cup. Number four, the infamous angle involving Tom Pritchard, Tony Anthony, and Lady Mystic here. Yes, all this aired on the same day on Superstars. You have Rick Rude propositioning Cheryl Roberts, Barry Windham turning on Lex Luger. I believe it was NWA Worldwide where that aired. And then the tag team titles end up going back to Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Windham ends up with the Horsemen. But also on that day in Baltimore, Maryland. Actually, I'm not entirely sure. Don't quote me on that being in Baltimore, but the 1988 Crockett Cup took place, which was kind of awkward because they had to announce to the crowd that Windham had turned on Luger. So Sting teamed with Lex Luger to win the Crockett Cup tournament for 1988, which would be the final one. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Once again, I urge you to leave a 5-star review on iTunes/Apple Music, as it provides social proof that you are listening to this podcast and enjoying it and all that sort of good stuff. And also leave 5-star review for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well, because not only does it help me, it helps the other great shows that are on this feed that I talked about earlier on. Now, for next week's show, I had mentioned earlier that there's an episode of WWF Superstars from 1991 that has a big angle to close the show. And this one is from September 28th of that year. And Ric Flair has come onto the scene, and he is about to have his debut match on Superstars. But he takes a little detour towards the commentary booth, and all hell breaks loose. And it ends up with Vince McMahon getting carried off on a stretcher. So, have I teased it well enough? Well, we also have the Warlord on that show as well. And Bret Hart versus the Brooklyn Brawler, if that's your thing, as well. Spread the word for me for any cockamamie awards that might be out there where I can end up losing to the lapsed fan or something like that in the voting. Like I said, 4th to 5th place is enough for me. It's always enough to be nominated. Like I was saying to somebody before, hey, 1980 Best Picture, Empire Strikes Back wasn't even nominated. So I just, you know, take it in stride. I got too much else going on, you know. I just enjoy doing the show for the show's sake. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown. Time.
Honey, come here a minute. Let me explain something to you. We have a television program we're running.